Hear this episode ad-free by becoming a supporter at patreon.com/prettymuchpop. You can listen to your personalized Patreon feed on any podcast application, including Apple Podcasts or Spotify. This is Pretty Much Pop, a culture podcast trudging slowly toward you as you go mad with terror. Today we're discussing the first wave of classic monster movies from Universal Studios, all from the early 30s, the Depression, your Dracula, your Frankenstein, your Invisible Man, etc. I'm Mark Linsenmeyer, not afraid of anything I can simply drive away from.
I'm Al Baker, always walking the line between cheesy and iconic.
Hello, children of the night. This is Sarah Lynn Breck.
This is Lawrence Ware, and I am really, really, really slow, but I'm very beloved.
And we have a special guest. Please introduce yourself.
Hello, my name is Brucker Nurse from Autopsy, the horror movie, and I'm here to say, what's all this? Very excited to be on the show today.
Yes, so you can plug your show and Lawrence's appearance on it, which I guess directly gave rise to this.
Yes, I host a horror movie podcast called Autopsy, the horror movie. I love horror, and that's also why I'm here today. But also, I had Lawrence on recently to talk about probably one of the better slasher sequels. We talked about the 1981 Halloween 2 sequel. We had a ball talking about that and just how crazy of a lunatic Dr. Loomis is. So I'm excited for that to come out and people check that one out too.
Yes, we have discussed that franchise on this. And, you know, every Halloween we try to do something in the horror space. And Lawrence was throwing out ideas. Oh, we should do Smile 2. We should do the Smile thing, but that's coming out too late. It won't be out in time for us to record this and release it in time for Halloween. And then you came up with an idea. Like, Sarah doesn't really like horror movies. Let's think of some good introductory horror movies to get her into it. And one of the ones, Lawrence, you brought out was The Invisible Man, which got me thinking, it's absurd that we're familiar with all these Descendants, but I myself have not actually seen most of these original movies, or if I have, it's so far back in my past that I couldn't tell you anything about them. So I sort of shoehorned us into, we're only going to talk about The Invisible Man and its contemporaries, which I included The Mummy among them, but the official ones that we're going to watch were Dracula, Bride of Frankenstein, Invisible Man. Lawrence, say more by way of introduction of what's awesome here.
Well,
or not.
It was actually Brucker and I were kind of going back and forth with ideas because Brucker is a fan of the podcast. He really, really enjoyed the Halloween discussion of those films that we had. And he listened to Sarah. He realized, you know, Sarah was not a big fan of horror films. And he was the one who came up with the idea of, like, let's try to come up with a list of movies that might convince Sarah to at least consider it. And among those movies was The Invisible Man. He can talk about why, but nevertheless, he thought that The Invisible Man is a really good kind of entryway into that. And that kind of got started with the whole conversation. Now, when it comes to these movies, I am more fond of them than I enjoy them, if that makes any sense.
Sure. Totally.
So with these films, like The Invisible Man, I hadn't seen that one in a while. I enjoyed that one a little bit more than I remembered.
Oh, yeah. No, that's an actually good movie.
Like, yeah, that one was a little bit more enjoyable than I remember.
That one's legit.
Dracula, Brucker and I was just talking about this not long ago. The last few times I watched Dracula, I fell asleep on those things. Like, I was falling asleep in the house. I actually went to a movie screening, fell asleep in the movie theater. Like, it was all bad. So I'm very fond of those movies. I think they're very kind of seminal, kind of touchstones. I think it's fascinating that those movies remain very culturally relevant, that every Halloween, any kind of candy display is going to feature Frankenstein. It's going to feature Dracula. It's kind of hard to feature the Invisible Man because you won't see him, but he's there.
Glasses, just glasses, yeah, exactly. And bandages glasses over the top of his head.
He's naked. He's naked. You just don't see him. He's naked. But the point is that these movies are really kind of seminal Halloween films, seminal films when it comes to horror movies. And so if you're going to talk about the contemporary films, the Conjurings, the, you know, whatever, there's an interesting Wolfman movie coming out next year. Really looking forward to seeing that. But if you're going to talk about these new films, you have to kind of begin with the OGs, with the originals. And so I'm very fond of them. They have a special place in my heart. I would probably not have watched them this Halloween season had not we've been doing this.
Sarah, any opening thoughts? Having are you lying awake at night, terrified?
I was so scared of
she
Dracula.
Was not
oh my gosh!
At all. And, get
and
out
that,
of here.
Yeah, the lighting right on his eyes. I was like, ooh.
That is, I mean,
William Shatner lighting. That's where that came from. I learned.
Wow.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, in Star Trek, the original series, whenever there's an intense William Shatner moment, they always light his eyes like a visor in a real close-up. And
oh
I always thought
God.
That was just a William Shatner thing, but it turns out he's doing Dracula.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that is so funny. I never knew that. I do have a past with these movies. When I was very small, they had like a Saturday night monster movie night, and I watched all of these movies. And, you know, as a 6, 7, 8-year-old, I was legitimately frightened.
Really?
As an almost 53-year-old, I am no longer frightened of Frankenstein and Dracula and the Invisible Man. But it was fun to kind of go back and see these, and especially with the literature background. You know, of course, I've read Mary Shelley. I've read Bram Stoker. And it was really fun with the literature background to go back and see how they track. And there's not much there thematically. There isn't much there in the movies. But it is fun actually to see Mary Shelley make an appearance in Bride of Frankenstein, for sure.
That was such a goofy thing that the original Frankenstein movie adaptation killed off everybody so that they decide, and they didn't have her come back at the end of it or something. I thought maybe the framing
she
device.
She was the bride.
Yeah, she was
she
the
played
bride.
The bride.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Still, it was a
and she was gorgeous. So no, she was as the bride. I was like, wow, you are gorgeous, lady. That is, you are working it. Anyway, go ahead, Brucker. Sorry.
Absolutely. No, I agree with all those points about the whole them not even coming back to like book ending it with Mary Shelley and Byron in like the original like creepy Swedish house that they're in or whatever. But yeah, it's kind of like the funny and kind of charming thing about these older movies is that once they end, they just end. Like, all right, we got to our point. We it's done. Like end credits. Here we are. And even like some of the Hammer films are like that too. Like as soon as like they kill the monster or like they rescue the girl, it's like, all right, movie's over. Here are the players. And there's no book ending at all.
I'm imagining a scene, if this movie was made more recently, that, you know, they'd go back to Mary Shelley and Lord Byron and her husband would be, oh, how did you come up with such a wonderful story? And she's like, I'll never tell. And she shows how she has a stripe in her hair that is all real.
It'd also be twice as long if they made it today, by the way. Wouldn't be a short hour and 15 minutes.
We need to normalize 75-minute movies. I really enjoyed the run times of these.
Oh, me.
Al, any initial thoughts? Had you experienced a lot of these before? Was this fresh?
Like Sarah and anyone else who's studied literature at any level, I have an interminable familiarity with Gothic horror because that seems to be all anyone wants to talk about in undergraduate literature courses. So I've seen the original Dracula movie as well as Nosferatu before and Frankenstein. However, at the time, I kind of just bundled them both together as like pretty, you know, fine, boring, interesting, but not very enjoyable. This time rewatching them, I was really surprised at how much fun I had with all of them. And I think the key was in watching all these movies, I decided to try and put myself in the position of someone who had never watched like any Dracula movie before, had never seen a Frankenstein movie before, had never seen a kind of monster movie before. And I also tried to pay close attention to the choices that the actors and the filmmakers were making in the context of no one having done this before. Mm-hmm. So it's really easy to look at, you watch Dracula and you think, okay, this is the cheesiest Dracula you've ever seen. But if you watch Dracula and you think Bela Lugosi is making all these choices for the first time, it becomes intensely interesting to watch. So the, like all the hissing and the hands and hiding behind the elbow, they're all cheesy tropes now, but you're seeing Bela Lugosi make these choices for the first time and you think this guy is a genius. And all of these lead actors, something that jumped out to me hugely through all these films, especially Claude Rains, they have incredible screen charisma. Like, you cannot take your eyes off
absolutely
any of the lead characters. And even by contrast to the other people on screen, you can just see that these are stars. And another piece of amazing context is people had only been making talking films for 5 years at this point. They have no playbook to work from. They're putting in these world-beating classic performances, and it's just really impressive. I had a great time seeing it.
I want to figure out how much I should or not talk about The Mummy. Did other people watch that?
I watched it.
I've seen it before, but I did not rewatch it.
So, yeah, the Tom Cruise one?
No. The original.
Earlier.
No, the original one.
Okay. Well, you were talking, Mark, about the Tom Cruise movie, and I did try to watch a little bit of it, and it's, ugh.
It's really bad.
Well, I think it's just because the Universal tried to revive this as the monster universe, that this is one of their ongoing properties, is this version of Frankenstein and this version of Dracula. And so any sort of modern touchstones, apparently the Renfield, which I had been sort of sitting in my queue for a while, I didn't realize.
Mm-hmm. It's pretty good.
It's great.
Watching that right after Dracula, like it's so fun because they actually recreate some of the scenes with the original non-letterbox size screen and crappy film that, like, they put those actors in shot for shot, very, very short recreations of scenes from the original film. So that was neat.
The Mummy was terrible. Renfield was fine. The New Invisible Man was really, really good. Mm-hmm. Like, that one is a really good film.
The 1999 one or the 2021?
No, Brucker, help me out. Was that 20? That was 2019, wasn't it? It was right before the pandemic.
The Invisible Man, the Lee Whannell movie, that was 2020.
Mm-hmm. 2020. So it was right before the pandemic. Because I remember that was the last movie that I saw in the movie theater before everything shut down. So that one is really, like, genuinely a very, very good movie. It has Elizabeth Moss. It's very well done. And he did so well with that, they gave him the opportunity to do The Wolfman, which is going to be the next film that he's going to make. So Lee Whannell is doing some interesting things with Universal monster movies. But back to this, I saw The Mummy. Mummy is a touchstone. Mummy was a film that actually genuinely scared me when I was younger.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I was like surprised just watching the opening scene of that with my wife and how slowly it moves, but like, and no music at all.
Mm-hmm.
That it is actually just pure suspense. That was sort of my, okay, I'm sold. I could watch some of these old movies. You know, it's a very similar thing to Dracula in that there's a guy that they show his eyes close up and he is communicating with a woman at a distance. And that's the whole plot of the thing, is to try to seduce and sorcel and ultimately destroy some woman from a distance. But Boris Karloff, I didn't realize, you know, from Frankenstein that he could actually act, that as this mostly not a guy wrapped in bandages, mostly, you know, some sort of interestingly makeuped, withered Egyptian tall man, Imhotep, was quite good.
Yeah, I mean, like, I think that the casting for, like, these classic monsters, you know, Bela Lugosi, Boris Karloff, and Claude Rains was all really good. And I believe, like Al was mentioning earlier, with Bela Lugosi make these, like, interesting decisions, you know, kind of like for the first time them figuring things out on film. And I find, like, Lugosi kind of like carrying that movie, Lauren said earlier, but I really do enjoy, like, the first 15-20 minutes of Dracula. I find the rest of it to be kind of a slog. But Lugosi, I think his performance does carry it. And with what was mentioned earlier, with like him hiding behind a cape, the fingers, the staring and everything is very expressionistic. And it feels like you really feel like how it's carrying, like, the evolution of going kind of like from silent or even like stage plays to the talkies here. And I think a lot of it also helped was that, like, Lugosi was actually playing Dracula on Broadway before he did the movie. So I feel like a lot of that kind of expressionistic sort of thing helped carry over into his performance in the movie too, which I thought was just, again, really cool seeing them kind of figure this stuff out for the first time.
And he was a star. Like, it was something that, like, he developed on Broadway and then they took it to film. And it was clear that, I mean, just like you said, Lawrence, like, you can't stop looking at this guy. He just absolutely grabs your attention. And it's not just his face. His face is everything, but also his voice and his movement and just how big he is. I imagine it was something that people really hadn't seen before on stage or on film.
It was impressive to me how much these movies developed in such a short time. Like, I watched four of them. And Universal made Frankenstein directly after Dracula was such a huge hit, right? But it's so much more, it seems to me, so much more cinematic Frankenstein than Dracula, even though they made it directly afterwards. Dracula very much seems like a filmed version of a stage play in a lot of respects.
It does.
But Frankenstein, like the cinematography in Frankenstein, the sets, the composition of the shots, it's all so much more complicated. And it's the same year. So is this just like, so you guys know more about the cinema of the period. Is that just that Dracula was just a little bit cheap. They made and then they put more money into the later ones. Or
and was a stage play, right? They adapted the stage play directly.
Or was there really, what was there development of technique between the two?
I think it's more about the directors Browning versus like James Whale, where Browning, I think he was like a huge titan during like the silent era, but Dracula was his first time getting his feet wet with the talkies. And I think it kind of showed like a little bit like the struggle with it, because simultaneously while they were filming Dracula at night, a whole second crew would come in filming the Spanish version. And the Spanish crew, they even had special effects in it. It's technically regarded as the more like superior film, even though like they're filmed using the same stages and sets, but they were more ambitious with using, being okay with doing like special effects and everything like that. And I feel like with Dracula, what like stands out technically is more of like the camera movements that they're doing. Like they're kind of like moving the camera a little bit differently now, like going through rooms. And that's more to the cinematographer on that, which I believe like most of like the cast and crew like regarded him as mostly directing over Browning. And in fact, the cinematographer went on to direct The Mummy too. So I think it's just like the differences between them and like Whale being a little bit more ambitious and finding people that were willing to try out new things and like go beyond with the special effects. Like The Invisible Man and both The Bride of Frankenstein have like really impressive stuff for the time. Amazing. I mean, I think it still stands out today. Like, it's like, wow, this is incredible to look at.
Sorry, I do need to ask a follow-up question on the incredible bomb that you just dropped. They made these movies during the day and then brought in a Spanish cast and crew so that they could use the same sets and film the same scenes overnight. They made two movies
just
at the same
time. Yeah.
Just for Dracula. Yeah.
I thought you were going to say that's just what Universal did.
No, it was just for Dracula. No. It was just that one film.
Because they hadn't figured out dubbing yet, I guess. Or
subtitle, yeah.
This is the beginning of it all, man. They hadn't figured that out whatsoever.
I wonder if the sound on Dracula was as bad at the time as we are hearing, because it was so loud, the hiss. I just couldn't get past it. Like, it's something that would be easily fixable now with a modern update, and I didn't notice it on any of the others, so it was very distracting to me.
Yeah.
I genuinely don't know, because I've seen that many times in many different settings, and the hiss has never been as loud as the one that I saw on Amazon. And so maybe it just might be what Amazon is doing. I genuinely don't know. We can get to The Bride of Frankenstein, but the one that really stood out to me was The Invisible Man. That movie was really fun. It's hard to say action-packed, but it was action-packed. I mean, like, it was
action-packed.
There's two different montages in it, which I didn't expect to see in a 1933 movie. So that was pretty cool. And also, it like, helped with the pacing, too, of like, we got to keep this thing moving. Let's have a couple montages in here.
Because it does a good job of establishing like what's going on, and the character is kind of evil, but then you learn a little bit more about the character. But then I thought the special effects were really good for the 1930s, right? Very convincing. Something that I could imagine a film school student doing now, right? So I was really, really taken aback by really how good that movie was. The pacing was really good. And it was not scary. Now, I don't know her name. Maybe you know the name, Brooker, but the woman who is like, I think she's at the tavern and she like really overacts.
Una O'Connor.
Yeah, she's over the top. She's really over the top. Yeah.
Like that. She's in all these movies.
I found her delightful. I will watch everything she's in now. I thought she was just so funny.
Yes, she is hilarious.
I couldn't stand her.
She was not the same actress in Bride of Frankenstein, right? The servant. Mm-hmm. Oh, it was the same woman. Okay.
Yeah, same woman.
She was just over the top. I mean, if you want to give out an award for overacting, she wins it. I mean, she was over the top.
100%.
But it was so good. I really enjoyed that film.
Yeah. And it's also like pretty funny too. I mean, like as it is a horror movie, I also found it to be like purposely funny. Like with like Una O'Connor, I think is like hamming it up, which I think helps. The Invisible Man, he, while like a villain and he does like do and say some like, you know, like awful things, I just kind of like find it funny, just like the little like gags that he was doing at first, like just stripping naked in front of the police and just chasing them while wearing a shirt. It's kind of like a funny, like it's something that you would see like in Scooby-Doo almost, I think. Like I found it all just entertaining.
The dancing pants. Yeah.
Yeah. Claude Rains is really evil in the kind of delicious way. Like, you're really cheering him up when he kicks the guy out of the car in the last thing. Oh, like, so long, sucker. That's just, you're with him all the way.
His plans for world domination are not very well thought out.
They're not.
You must stand next holes. To me and wash my feet at all times. Like, he's thought about this. But he hasn't thought about the actual mechanics of
yeah, exactly.
not merely being locked in a room. Like, okay, you've caught the invisible man by locking him in a room. The end.
But by shooting Claude Rains' performance really drives the pacing of that movie.
It does.
Like, as soon as he's there, and he's got this brilliantly intense bitterness that's just driving all the way through him, and it just seeps through the screen. The other movies are sort of Frankenstein, Bride of Frankenstein, Dracula. Like, the pacing is less... It feels less urgent.
Yeah.
And I think that comes down to the fact that the leads there don't have as clear and overpowering a motivation as Claude Rains clearly does. Like, the sense of wrongness and injustice and ambition that you feel. Like, you understand why he's in a hurry, and you understand why everyone else is desperate to catch him. And the stakes are really clear. And it just makes everything feel snappy.
It does. And there's a clear question of, like, how is this town going to catch a guy you can't see? And actually, I thought that was pretty funny. All of the different ways that they did try to catch him. Like, what was the deal with all of them holding hands, hoping to that? I mean, I don't know.
It was a great visual.
Their methods
it didn't make any sense, but it was a great visual. No,
it was really funny. Anyway.
Everyone's so phlegmatic in it as well. My favorite line in the film is when there's the big reveal where he strips naked in front of them, and then the policeman outside says, "He's invisible. That's his problem." And that's going to make him jolly difficult to catch.
The constable is so good. That's what I know. Oh, I said it in my opening. That's one of my favorite lines from this movie. Him just going, "What's all this?" It's just fantastic. I did want to go back to something that you set out with the pacing and how, like, the Invisible Man and like the performance of it. It felt like there was kind of like this urgency, which led to, like, kind of like a faster pace, while, like, Bride of Frankenstein and Dracula was a little bit slower. And I think it kind of, at least to me, something I like to talk a lot about on my show are, like, the types of fears that the movies and, like, filmmakers are, like, tapping into. And I think you just pointed out something that's, like, really interesting about what I was thinking about, like, the types of fears that these are tapping into, and, like, how the pacing even kind of played along into that. Because with The Invisible Man, you talk about how that's, like, kind of, like, faster paced. The first time I watched that movie was, I think, like, 2018 or 2019. So it was, like, during, like, the Trump administration. And for some reason, it just really spoke to me about how you should fear people that come to power very quickly. Because, yes, he's a scientist. He did all, like, these trials. But again, he developed a superpower in a matter of days without really having too many trials and failures into, like, learn, like, the consequences of, like, of his actions. And, like one of the side effects he didn't realize was that the monocaine would, like, drive him mad. And I think that's, like, was behind some of his, like, evil thoughts and everything. And so that kind of felt like that was also part of the pace, but, like, this person rising to power very quickly and how dangerous that would be for everybody. While instead, like, Bride of Frankenstein, that is a little bit more slower paced. That to me was, that movie talked so much about just the fear of, like, rejection. I really think that kind of, like, played through James Whale's, there's kind of through osmosis of him, like, directing it, because him being an openly gay man in the 1930s and 40s, I'm sure faced some sort of discrimination or just, like, rejection. And I feel like it really kind of came through with the many moments of Frankenstein's monster trying to, like, just seek companionship and friendship. And, you know, he's his friend good, and he loses that friendship with the monk that accepted him. And the movie really does kind of slow down there at that point to really, like, focus in on this. It doesn't want you to rush through it. It felt like that was kind of, like, the centerpiece. Like, if you were to walk away with anything, he wants you to walk away with, like, kind of like the heart of the movie is losing that sort of companionship or friendship because of the monster can't help how he was born, right? And that's why he's being rejected. And that really, that to me kind of, like, also played into the pacing of, like, wanting to slow it down and make sure that message seeped through. While Invisible Man, this is all very quick. Look how quick this is happening. Look how scary this is escalating very quickly. And so I feel like the pacing played into those two fears.
I know I had watched Bride of Frankenstein many years ago, but I did not remember these really weird, "I too have created life. Look, I have little people in jars." And they're very horny little people.
I didn't remember that either. And I wondered, I also watched Frankenstein. I got a little extra credit for this episode. Frankenstein first, and then I watched Bride. I actually remember a lot of Frankenstein. And thematically, that one is about obsession, you know, whereas
it is.
The second one is really about rejection.
I did have a related question about horror themes, because one of the things, I'm an inexpert, I'm very cautious about horror movies in general, but of the better horror films I've seen, or the ones I enjoy more, seem to me to be, especially recent ones, seem to me to be very clear thematically and very focused on a particular kind of horror that they're trying to explore. So we talked about The Exorcist last year, a couple of years ago, and I was really taken with the original Exorcist about how focused it is on the horror involved in having your faith shaken. And that seems to be like what the real focus of The Exorcist is. And hearing you, Brecker, describe like similar, I guess, creative choices at play in these super early horror movies is really interesting to me, because I wanted to ask about what is the kind of horror that these movies are dealing with, and to what extent are those kinds of choices that they make in terms of like what makes a horror film, like what are you trying to do when you're trying to make a horror film, how far that's impacted the history of horror cinema in the same way as like the characters and the stories and the performances have.
I don't know, because like I said, I like to like really look into like the types of fears that are being presented and like how they kind of like build around it. But I've been told by other people that do make horror movies, or like at least like read scripts that are being proposed to be made, they always say the people that like go say, I want to make a horror movie, those are like normally like the worst scripts that like they see. It's normally like there's something else there that then it kind of develops into like, oh, this is actually kind of fearful, like what you're putting together. And like, you know, these early movies, they're monster movies and like they are like horror movies, but like they do have other things that they talk about. But besides like the most common fear, I think, like every horror movie is like the fear of death or extinction, which is, I think, prevalent in all of these. But I think like there's like bigger themes being put into these that, because, you know, they're not so much focused on the killing or the dying in these. That is the point of it. That's the point of it being scary. Like, I think if you are making death and dying the main focus, you get movies like Terrifier, right? Like where like you get like these very like splashy, slasherific type of movies. But like with these, like there's other like themes, like with, I know I just talked about The Invisible Man and The Bride of Frankenstein, but like with Dracula, there's kind of like this weird undertone of like xenophobia in it.
Definitely.
And strange man coming to your country and stealing up all the women and land too. Yeah. And but what I found like interesting about that, because I was reading some arguments about it saying that, well, if you take that as Dracula being the villain with the xenophobia in it, Van Helsing, he's also a foreigner in the movie too, and he's kind of like the opposition to Dracula in it. He's the guy that knows how to vanquish him. But what I find interesting about just linking back into like the xenophobia of it is that with Van Helsing also being a foreigner, he's the only one that knows how to stop the other foreigner. Like while like the locals in London, they don't know what a vampire is. They don't know how to deal with this. But the foreigner says, oh, I know how to deal with this. We know exactly how to approach this. And like, I'm going to be the one to kind of walk you through this because y'all have never had to deal with this before kind of thing. So I don't think that that was the purpose of what Browning was trying to do in the movie. It's obviously subjective, but that is there. And I feel like that does kind of, whether on purpose or by accident, kind of does play into sort of things of like, you see him walking the streets of London, you see him starting to, by various ways, seduce the women in London. It does kind of come through that way.
But, you know, the thing is that horror movies at their best, and this is what drew me to horror films, at their best. Now, Terrifier, I've never seen those. I don't know if I'm ever going to watch those, because those are like splatter horror, really gory. It's just, I don't like that necessarily. A little bit of gore is fine, but when gore is all that you do, I'm not a big fan of that. It reminds me of like body horror and that kind of stuff. But horror films at their best, you think about Godzilla, you think about Michael Myers and Halloween, you even think about on a certain level, Jason Voorhees, like horror is always a stand-in for something else. They're talking about something else. And they're using the vehicle of horror films to do that, but they're talking about something else. And so when you talk about The Invisible Man, yes, it's a fun horror film, but there's other things on its mind. Frankenstein, fun horror film, Actually, I don't even know if it's a horror film. Honestly, it feels like more of a drama, but whatever. But other things on its mind, right? Sci-fi drama? I don't know. But the point is that a horror film at its best, when it's at its best, you think about Get Out now, or you think about Us, you know,
yeah.
It has other things on its mind. Yes, it's using the vehicle of horror, but that's what got me in, is the idea that, yes, this is going to be a fun rump time and we're going to watch people die. But I walk away thinking about something else. I walk away thinking about the fear of the encroachment of violence into suburbia with Halloween. Or I walk away thinking about the way that people kind of deal with their faith with The Exorcist, right? That's mm-hmm. or the Omen. Like, it gives you the opportunity to have fun, but also explore extremely deep and sometimes dark themes that you really can't explore in any other kind of way, not really meaningfully.
If you think about it, this is a 1931 film. If you look at Dracula, for example, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. and it is updating or modernizing a Victorian
Absolutely.
Text.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean?
You're right.
And they are taking some of those themes, but they have to, it can't be about the same old Victorian themes about gender and sexuality that they were exploring at the time and that were genuinely scary for that culture at the time. So they had to modernize it in a way. And I love what you said, Brucker. It was so smart about, it was about xenophobia. You know, that's what, how you modernize it in the early 1930s. And you've seen Dracula modernized over and over and over again. And it's, there's a reason why. I mean, Lawrence, I can't believe I'm agreeing with you about horror, but I think that there's a reason why we keep coming back to these same tropes, is because we can make them work no matter where we are in our culture.
Come on in the room, Sarah. Come on in the room.
Yes. Come on in. There's plenty of room.
I think it's a different thesis, though, to say there can be other stuff going on there. In other words, like the M. Night films that we just did that are really family dramas, but like, let's put some aliens in it. Let's put a ghost in it. But they're not really about the supernatural or sci-fi elements. They're about, so that's one way of just marrying two things. I saw an interview with Paul Feig recently about comedies, and he's like, don't just do a comedy. That's really hard. Do an action comedy, do a horror comedy, because it's just so much easier to do the thing that you want to actually present, the minute by minute entertainment, if it is in some frame. But I think that's very different by having, like, let's put something in a horror movie frame from what you were saying about Get Out specifically, or, you know, I feel like Stephen King has thought a lot about what actually scares people. Mm-hmm. And investigating fear itself, not just, okay, we're going to have a horror movie structure, and maybe it's not even that scary, but it's just sort of there to hang some acting and, you know, other performances on, is very different than we actually want. And I was trying to figure out with these films, like, were they thinking hard about what is fundamentally scary? And I guess they were, but it is harder to see at this distance of, like, what exactly they thought was, like, Frankenstein, that in particular, there was almost nothing.
Nothing scary to me.
I guess I was taking a little too seriously. Like, some point toward the end, Frankenstein, he's, like, tossing some guy off of a roof. And it, like, it was kind of a very visceral, like, can you just let him run away? So there's just something about actually being murdered. The fact that this guy would just go around and strangle people and throw them around, and that, you know, that you could take that very personally, but it's not a very, you know, deep meditation on horror.
I'm going to suggest that a part of this might be a really interesting kind of cultural accident, because Dracula was the first, like, big one of these movies. And you're right, Sarah, it's important to remember that this is, like, a Victorian thing. Although that was only 40, 50 years previously. So, like, in terms of moving the culture forward, it's kind of like the recent film version of Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, right? It's a 50 years later adaptation of something that...
Yeah, Dracula was around 30, 35 years before the movie, the book was. And Frankenstein, Mary Shelley's book...
That was 18th century.
That was in the middle of, or maybe 1830s. So beginning of the 1800s. So yeah, so that was much earlier.
But what's interesting is that Dracula was the first of these movies and is an adaptation of a literary classic. And maybe filmmakers approaching Dracula and then Frankenstein, these, like, giant stories of literature, maybe felt that they owed a little, like, serious thought. There was maybe a bit like, okay, this isn't just a piece of schlock that we're making. This is an adaptation of a literary classic. And so maybe some, like, thoughtfulness is owed hearing like especially again, because we're talking about an adaptation of a stage play where some beard strokey thoughtfulness is going to have gone into the performances and the staging and the kinds of things they're trying to explore. And then if you compare that to like The Mummy, which isn't based on a literary classic, is much less thoughtful. There's much less depth of theme and exploration of deep horror going on. So maybe there's just a really lucky accident we've had in the history of horror cinema where the early foundational films of the genre happen to be based on very important, worthy works of gothic horror, where a lot of the kind of heavy lifting has already been done for the filmmakers in terms of these are the themes you want to explore. This is what the kind of horror is that you're dealing with. And so we can make something that's really like meaty and great.
I never really thought about them like purposefully choosing these works of literature because of like, you know, they have something important and profound in them because people have been interested in them for years. I immediately went to, oh, Universal want to do it because it's a cash grab and people are already familiar with this. There's less upfront work you got to do to get your audience up to speed with like who these characters are and what the rules are and everything. But
yeah,
I like your proposal better because it's less cynical. So I like that.
I think the cynical take is right for the production. Like the reason that they made Frankenstein is because people have heard of it. But then maybe once you put the guy behind the camera, he's mm-hmm. like, okay, how am I going to make this movie? And then you've got 200-300 years of literary criticism to fall back on to inform everything that you're putting on screen.
IP, baby.
Yeah.
Google is telling me that the thing about The Mummy is in 1922 was the opening of the tomb of Tutankhamun. And that supposedly
there were early deaths
of several people involved in the expedition. So there was a fear, you know, this talk of a curse. It was sort of an urban legend that was going around at the time based on real news events.
Oh, that's interesting.
These movies did not find these particularly scary. Do you think that these are movies that are too old for modern audiences? Do you think that my 16-year-old and my 8-year-old would want to watch these movies? Or are these just like staples of a bygone era that no longer really, not really worth watching anymore? Like, what do you guys think about that?
I think that's a false dichotomy. Maybe they're too old to be scary for the reasons we talked about Dracula. Like, a foreigner creating wantonness in women is hardly the stuff of like earth-shattering modern horror. But gothic deals in universal and historical themes that we can all like connect to on some level, like the lack of autonomy that Dracula like creates around him is, it's not horrifying to watch on screen, but you can connect to, like, you understand what the horror is that they're dealing in. You can connect with that on some way. I think The Invisible Man is genuinely a little unnerving.
The Invisible Man is good. Yeah, that one's a good one. That's a good one.
Maybe just because I'm not a horror fan. I don't need to be scared to enjoy a horror movie. I just need, I need an interesting exploration of a fear.
I agree with that. As someone that is chronically watching horror movies, I'm not typically scared too often by horror movies, but I am just like intrigued and I like the mental exercise of like, you know, trying to dig up, you know, what are the fears that I should be picking up on. I don't know if I would consider these scary to a modern audience. However, I wonder if you were to put like a 5-year-old and have them watch Dracula, would they be scared of just like the close-ups, like mean faces of Dracula and seeing how easy it is for him to sneak into your bedroom while you're sleeping? Because like that to me is a big fear of kids, is like monsters under the bed and look how easy it was for him to just get in your room and you're helpless at that point. So I don't know. I wonder if that would scare a kid today, but I don't want to test that.
Kids would be afraid that screens are going to shrink by 3 inches, that the color is going to drain from the world, that a loud hissing will be around them at all times.
That might be what scared them. Otherwise, they'd fall asleep.
Or Una O'Connor.
There's a giant puppet bat right outside of your window.
Oh, man. That's the thing that killed me. They didn't even bother to, like...
That's not great.
The sound of the wings flapping or anything is just this silent bat.
It's really not fair to shit on this movie for the production choices, but
no.
But straight after they have the rubber bat, the guy goes and out the window and shouts, he's turned into a dog off screen.
Right.
It does seem a little unfair.
I also laugh every time at the beginning of Dracula where they do that up close shot of her holding the rosary and it's so out of focus. I was worried that like my internet connection wasn't great when I was streaming.
But don't you think that there's value in seeing these films as a piece of history. You know, I mean, there are films that, you know, from every single era that represent that era. And I do think that that's worthwhile, but also recognizing that they are in a historical context. And I think that would make my 20-year-old daughter interested. I don't think she would go and see that movie as a representation of horror as she knows it, but it's horror as the audiences from back then knew it. And I think that in and of itself is worthwhile.
Yeah, absolutely.
It bears repeating that like 75 minutes is not a big ask of someone.
That's an episode of Stranger Things. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. And in terms of like a rewarding hour of film to watch, that's great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And like for like the historical context too, because I always think it's really cool to go back to see like how far back tropes can go and do go. Like with Dracula, mm-hmm. I love we get all of like the same tropes that we get in like a modern slasher. You know, you have like the Harbinger at the beginning of it. It's so good. The victims still being picked off one by one. You have the terrible place, the evil lair, Castle Dracula. I guess it's like up for debate if Mina could be like considered a prototype final girl. I don't know, but it's kind of cool seeing like the tropes right there from the movie kicking off the monster franchise.
Yeah. Or even the castle in Frankenstein, just seeing that castle on a hill. It's like, was that the first time we've seen that? I don't know.
I don't know.
But how many times have we seen it since?
many times. I will say that the production design in these movies is really good. I really enjoyed that.
Oh, yeah.
The costume design, for example, the Bride of Frankenstein, the way that she is designed, it's so beautiful. It's so good.
Beautiful.
It's so kind of creepy. Like, that's one thing that really kind of stood out to me with all these films is that, yeah, they may be old, but the production design is really good. The costuming is really good. The makeup is quite good as well. And then for the time, the lighting, the cinematography, really good. Kind of now, Dracula's kind of static. It's not as charismatic a movie, if you will. But the other movies, like, they're trying things with that big ass camera that they had back in the day. Like, they're trying to do some things that are really interesting. So I really enjoyed that part of it. It was really kind of a standout for me.
That's why we're talking about going back to these for like seeing things and trying to relate to it to like modern stuff. Every time I watch The Invisible Man and like Claude Rains' performance, it really reminds me of, this is going to sound crazy, but like Heath Ledger's Joker performance in The Dark Knight a little bit.
Interesting.
Just because you're getting the laugh. You're getting the dude that has, not globally, but specifically a town, like on edge with the crazy antics and crimes that he is committing. And he's invisible, so like that is a superpower, but like, you know, it's not like he has super strength or speed or anything like that.
Apparently his madness has made him kind of strong.
Okay,
at least one of the things, I can throttle you and choke you better than, you know, even if you know that I'm there. Once somebody gets their hands on your throats, you sort of know where they are.
Yeah,
so you should be, if your hands are free, you should be able to fight them, you know, give them a good kick in the groin. But anyway, he's strong.
Yeah, strong guy for sure. But and the whole him giving Kemp the countdown to his death, you know, I will kill you at 10 o'clock tomorrow night. It really made me think back to that scene in The Dark Knight where he's like, I'm a man of my word. I'll keep killing people until you reveal yourself, Batman. It's probably the laugh really that sticks out to me that makes me go, that kind of sounds like the Joker. But I feel like there's like some loose threads there.
You're pointing out how I feel like for these things to have momentum, there has to be a problem-solving element to it. And probably the detective fiction, you know, Hound of the Baskervilles and stuff, is sort of the grandparent of this horror stuff. Invisible Man is the most explicit, but also in Dracula, it's like, okay, we figured out what this monster is. How are we going to beat it? Mm-hmm. Let's brainstorm. Let's try different things. Oh, that plan didn't work. And, you know, so that actually gives it like some resolution as opposed to just, here's a scary thing. Aren't we scared? Okay, that movie's over.
Like, right.
You don't need a lot for an hour, you know, just over an hour. But I guess maybe as a final topic, I'm glad we focused on just this really early period where it was actually still supposed to be scary, because the line between this and schlock in camp is so quick, such that, you know, these movies are making money. Let's immediately put out 9.
Yeah, it makes a left turn real fast. Yeah,
to all of them. Oh, we got to get it. You know, people might wonder why we haven't talked about the Wolfman. I didn't realize that was like a second generation. That was the 1940s thing. Creature of the Black Lagoon, 1950s thing, that these were sort of in the Universal staple. I didn't also realize that Phantom of the Opera was included in here. It was a Universal thing from like 1925. So it was a silent film.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't know if it seems like there was some Mr. Hyde stuff coming in here.
Yeah,
and there.
There was. Yeah, there was a Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde. I forget what year. I want to say it was in the 30s when that came out. But yeah, that was included in this as well. It's actually, that's a pretty good movie, actually. That one is.
But yeah, we very quickly get to just complete retread. And then let's have the monsters meet up. Let's do crossovers. And then let's get freaking Abbott and Costello to sort of ruin everything. Sarah is rejoicing. On your recommendation, I watched the first half of that yesterday, Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein. And I do have nice childhood memories of watching some Abbott and Costello stuff, I'm sure, including some of these films as a child. But I just did not care.
Yeah, it was.
I was ready to not laugh very much, but I laughed some. I thought some of it was really funny. And I actually kind of loved that the monsters were playing it straight. Like, that was kind of the best part for me. They weren't, it was like they were in a different movie than Abbott and Costello.
I have never seen that movie and I would never watch that movie.
Well, your villains need to stay scary. They can't break. Yeah.
No, yeah. Bela Lugosi was not breaking. He was absolutely 100% in character, back in the makeup. Oh, and it did make me think of, we were just talking about Ed Wood last time. Mm-hmm. It made me think of, this is an older version of Bela Lugosi. I was like, oh, I hope you're okay.
Spoiler, he wasn't okay.
No.
Yeah, and I kind of want to learn more about Lon Chaney Jr. too, who seems like was not as good an actor as the rest of these people, but because Lon Chaney Sr. was really famous and he was the Phantom of the Opera in the 1925 one, then Lon Chaney Jr. sort of got into this and maybe was pretty good in The Wolfman, but then got cast again and again in these things, including in Abbott and Costello, that he was the Wolfman in that, and is not a good actor. Really. So, like, how did he get this weird accidental inherited stardom or something and they keep using him?
If you look at the filmography of Lon Chaney Jr., a lot of those films are just lost, which speaks to me they didn't think about keeping them because he was not very good in those movies. So I do it because he's not a great actor. Like, he's had an iconic role. He's not a great actor, but a lot of those films, like, if you look at the filmography, they're just lost. They're gone. We don't know what happened to them. So yeah, he wasn't very, very good. He wasn't very memorable in the other stuff, but he had a good run. He did something cool.
And we had Glenn Strange take over the Frankenstein monster role, I noticed, in Abbott and Costello. Apparently, Boris Karloff had enough of Frankenstein.
Yeah, earlier than that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, he was probably done with the oil paint that they had to put on him.
Oh, yeah. I can see that.
Was Frankenstein the first example of doing the thing where you warn the audience in advance how terrifyingly scary? Like, I loved that. I'd forgotten this, that on screen before the first Frankenstein, a guy comes out in front of a curtain and says, just so you know, this is going to be real scary, guys. Are you sure you can handle it? Are you sure you can handle it? I think you look like very brave boys and girls to me, but I just want to make sure. Are you sure? And it was, and also, and in the opening credits, they have a big question mark instead of Boris Karloff's name. Was that because Karloff was a star, or was it because they wanted to imply that the monster was...
was real?
Was
human?
Was CGI? I love that,
the monster as himself. Yeah, it's
Well, Al, you just passed the audition. That if I make a movie where I need somebody to give that introduction, you're going to do that.
Coming out, because that was really great, Al. Actually, it really was.
Thank you.
Didn't Hitchcock or William Castle also kind of do that shtick too? Where, like, they'll sometimes come out and say,
Hitchcock,
like,
definitely did.
Yeah. I really wanted to ask, and maybe this is a good last question. Like, that we talked about the impact of these movies. So much of these movies reminded me of Hitchcock, and I wondered, like, is there a direct line, or is this just the way good cinema looked then? So Hitchcock took his cues from a broader range.
Well, Hitchcock was making movies. He started making movies in this silent era.
Yeah,
around, he?
Like, yeah, he did. He started earlier. Yeah, he did. So he was, I want to say, in his 30s or so, around the 30s and whatnot. Because if you watch the development of Hitchcock, you'll see that after these films, you begin to see him employing some of the techniques that these filmmakers were employing into his films. So I do think that there was a little bit of an influence on Hitchcock. But of course, Hitchcock took it and went to a whole new level because he's Hitchcock. But yeah, I do think that he saw them like, yo, that's cool. That's a really interesting kind of way to move the camera or to frame a scene or whatever. And he began to incorporate mm-hmm. that in some of his films post these films. Now, not the Abbott and Costello one. He wasn't influenced by the Abbott and Costello one because that one's a trash movie. But the good ones, he was definitely influenced by.
What?
You mm-hmm. heard me. I said what I said.
We were getting along so well, Lawrence. Come on.
Well, I got you interested. I got you interested.
It's definitely think of like a snake eating its own tail a little bit, especially in horror, because it's also like one of the things that I like so much about the genre. It's the filmmakers are kind of always kind of like nodding back to like what other mm-hmm. filmmakers have done
definitely,
too.
Definitely.
Whether it's, I don't want to say copying, but like kind of like, you know, lifting techniques and everything. The one I always go to is like Bob Clark's Black Christmas mm-hmm. opening up killer POV into the house. That's exactly how Halloween opens too. And they're like spiritual sisters to each other. So yeah, that's one of the fun things about the genre is that you're always kind of finding like repeated sort of techniques and like different skins.
Yeah. So that was the main purpose of watching these for me is to see what later filmmakers who also have watched these movies are taking from it and how much of, you know, if you haven't actually seen in Bride of Frankenstein, like the, what they do when they put the kites up and they put the rays that like, oh, Frank and Weenie copied this in, right. in a fun
Absolutely
way.
Did. Absolutely did.
You know, it's, if you didn't get the reference, wouldn't be as good.
It's really fun watching the first three Frankenstein movies, Frankenstein, Bride, and Son of Frankenstein, and then going and watching the Mel Brooks movie.
Young Frankenstein.
Yes.
And then, absolutely.
I watched Young Frankenstein first. My wife is a huge fan of that movie, so we watch that all the time. And then I went and rewatched those three Frankenstein movies I just mentioned. I was like, oh my God, it's aping so much of even Son of Frankenstein, the third installment into this. There's so much in that Mel Brooks movie. It's great.
It's funny though, just because we had so much history since then, watching the first two Frankensteins and how little we see of the monster and how the monster is come to life, mm-hmm. how we see the editing, you know, we go from, you know, seeing all of the lights and that we hear the sound of the thunder and all of the editing that goes into it. I couldn't help but think of like Jaws and what Spielberg was doing there how little of the actual shark we saw, but all of the other stuff around it was what created the suspense.
Oh, that's so good.
That's a wonderful point, Sarah.
Why, thank you.
I think we're friends again.
All right. That sounds like a good Lawrence. Point to end on. This a lot of extra thoughts coming to me from things we've said. You get to hear the what was most scary about the Dracula movie only in the supporter content that is patreon.com/prettymuchpop. But we'll say goodbye to you and the world for now. Have a happy, I don't want to say Halloween. That's terrible. Yeah.
All Hallows Eve.
Have a good one.
Happy Samhain.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
Goodbye. Pretty Much Pop is part of the Partially Examined Life podcast network. Get more Pretty Much Pop at prettymuchpop.com. Get bonus content for every episode at patreon.com/prettymuchpop.